Yes, we're right here.
Yes, we could just set it up.
Okay, if you just want to walk through the recording policy, we can lead right into Corey.
Good morning. This meeting will be recorded and available for your review on Rhode Island Housing's website within 3 to 5 business days after this meeting. Except for specific Rhode Island Housing staff, all callers will be muted during the meeting. To prevent any feedback or background noise, we ask participants, staff, to please mute your telephone if you are not speaking. If during the meeting anyone is having technical difficulties with the audio or accessing the call, they should call 401-457-1240. Thank you.
Good morning, this is Corinne Myers, General Counsel. Members of the public can visit the RI Housing website to view today's agenda and information on each of the actions being taken. If the teleconference portion is interrupted, we will stop the meeting until audio is restored. Chairman of the Credit Committee, Kevin Orth, will preside at this morning's meeting. Commissioners and staff, please state your name prior to speaking each and every time. And with that, I'll turn it over to Committee Chairman Orth to call the meeting to order.
Great. Thank you very much, Corinne. This is Chairman Orth. Now 9:41. I'd like to call the meeting to order. And James, please take a...
Certainly. This is James Comer, Chairman Kevin Orth.
Here.
Commissioner Maria Barry.
Here.
Commissioner Designee Sarah Cabral.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Great. Thanks. I would like to, I want to, before we move on to the first agenda item, is to just acknowledge that we have a super long agenda. I see that there's no lunch laid out. We'll try to go quickly but thoroughly at the same time. But I certainly would like, please don't let the length of the agenda keep you from asking any questions. Or have a good, robust discussion, because it's not always that we have so much money to dole out for projects. So they deserve some attention. Okay. That said, we'll move on to agenda item number one, which is approval of the minutes of the credit committee meeting held on April 12, 2023. I have a
motion.
I'll second it. Corinne, any discussion or comments on the minutes? No? Okay.
This is Corinne Myers. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending approval of the minutes of the credit committee meeting held on April 4th, 2023, please say aye.
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 I recuse myself. I wasn't there.
Okay. With 2 affirmative votes and 1 abstention, the motion is approved.
And before we go into each of the specific items, I'd like to ask Ann maybe to give an overview of what we're going to be talking about today.
5 minutes, 1 buyer, and 2x6, 2x8, 2x10, and
please mute your line if you're listening, Ann.
Thank you, Chairman. This is Ann Berman. And you're right, this is a very exciting and overwhelming agenda for us. I have asked staff, as you said, to be brief, but also hit the high points, and we're happy to answer any questions. So before we dive into the RFAs, I did want to take a minute to provide a quick overview of both the 9% LIHTC and then the larger RFP process. So we received 9 applications for the 9% LIHTC, requesting nearly $12 million worth of credits. We have about a little less than 3.2 to allocate, so oversubscribed nearly 4-1. Of the 9 applications we received, 8 did pass threshold, and the internal committee, which did include Chairman Orth, is recommending 3 projects for 9% credit. Simultaneously, staff completed the review of the 57 applications that applied for the myriad of funding opportunities in the consolidated RFP. We are bringing 8 tax-exempt proposals forward for recommendation. 7 of these are for preliminary approval for new development projects. 1 is for firm approval. And these 8 projects will utilize $83 million worth of tax-exempt bonds and will leverage more than $105 million of 4% equity, which is really tremendous. We are also recommending funding for a number of other projects that don't fit into these nice, neat buckets above. and do not require project-specific actions. But in total, we're awarding more than $101 million of subordinate debt to 21 projects, nearly 1,400 units, of which 1,198 are newly created. And of these, more than 350 will serve households below 30% of area median income. Since the majority of the funding recommendations are for preliminary, staff will be working with developers to move their projects through the due diligence phase and to firm approval as efficiently and quickly as possible. But as you know, it's a detailed process. In general, the current underwriting for each of these projects does conform to our requirements, based on what we know today for debt service coverage, loan to value, reserves, et cetera, except for one, and I want to point it out now so that it's out there. Most of these fail the second bridge loan test, but in order to minimize our exposure, staff is focused on three things, right? So making sure that we receive at least 15% of equity at closing. We're going to limit the size of the bridge loans to the minimum required to meet the 50% test, and this is both for to preserve the volume cap as well as to minimize our exposure. And as always, we will be actively engaged in the review of plans and specifications, review of the contracts, and we'll be closely monitoring construction to ensure that if there are any bumps in the road, we're well aware of them before they become big issues. And then finally, I just want to thank the entire staff. You've got four folks here, but you know, there's 25 people upstairs. And they really did a great job. We asked them to undertake a review of the largest RFP process we've ever done, and they did a great job. So I just want to say thank you.
Thank you for that, Anne. I think it would be very helpful if we could have a maybe a high-level summary spreadsheet showing the different funds and the amount available, how much has been allocated to date, how much remains. And then I think, like it should be on maybe the same spreadsheet, but maybe a different one that probably lists each development individually, how many units it's producing, maybe how much it was awarded in funding, and then, you know, where it's located in the state.
I think we have all of that on one chart, so we can prepare that before
okay.
The board meeting.
Maybe if we want to have a presentation or something, so we can just be highlighting that.
Sure.
I think it would be great just for, so that we can get our arms around all of this, but also just to be transparent
sure.
to everyone that's applied, and also obviously to advertise the impact that we're making with all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Okay, so we're ready to go.
Okay. One question. Yep. Oh, and just with a large number of applicants and then the narrowing down, do we have enough money for the deals that are being presented today to approve them? Like, is there enough?
Absolutely. Everything that we are
okay.
presenting today, based on what we know today,
okay.
Is fully funded.
Okay.
You know, for the most part, they need to go through due diligence, finish their plans and specs, get their final LOIs, but... you know, we think that they're fully funded as of today, and we will be working with the developers to make sure they understand that this is all the money they're going to get, and they need to make it work.
Okay, got it. Just wanted to make sure. Thank you.
All right, we'll now move on to agenda item two, which is recommendation for approval of reservation of low-income tax credits and preliminary approval of financing for Central Street development located in Pawtucket and Central Falls. And Stephanie, you'll
yep.
be presenting.
Good morning. Stephanie Booker here to present this request for action for preliminary approval of 2023 9% low-income housing tax credit and preliminary approval of a Rhode Island housing tax construction loan not to exceed $11 million, of which $3.2 million will remain as permanent first mortgage for the Central Street development. The developer is Pawtucket Central Falls Housing Corporation. The project is a mixed-use, mixed-income development on 12 scattered sites in Pawtucket and Central Falls. The new construction will have 30 units, 21 of which will be LIHTC units, and 9 units will be non-LIHTC with rents at 80% AMI. The preservation component will consist of 32 units, 22 of which will be LIHTC units, and 10 will be non-LIHTC with 80% AMI rents. The project includes two community service facilities, a home ownership center, and a tech hub, which will provide residents with access to high-speed internet. Housing vouchers and supportive services will also be provided through a partnership with Foster Forward for the youth aging out of foster care. In addition, the remaining capital stack will be funded by a community revitalization program loan, a capital magnet fund loan, developmental affordable housing funds, and middle income program funds, and a deferred developer fee. The project has been awarded $775,601 of Pawtucket Home and $650,000 of Federal Home Loan Bank AHP. The investor is National Equity Fund. The price per credit is 92 cents, and the first equity installment is 25% at closing. Happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you very much. Can I have a motion to approve?
So moved.
And I'll second it. Any comments or questions about this one? I'll throw out a question to you. Stephanie, do you have a breakout between the cost for the new construction piece and the rehab piece?
Yep. So the new construction cost per unit is $433,333, and the preservation per unit is $184,375. You're welcome.
Acrehab is one.
I'm sorry?
How much again was that?
For the preservation?
Yes.
$184,375.
And all of those costs, I'm assuming, have been looked at by design and construction?
Yes, I have.
Reasonable. Okay. I have one other question, and it's about the, I think this is the broader one, really, and as you brought up about the bridge loan. I think here we've got a syndicator in NEF who's, I mean, been in the state for a very long time. We have 25% going in up front, which seems good. I'm concerned, however, we still have a fair amount of repayment risk, not just with this deal, but we have a lot of deals that we're doing bridge loans on. So I don't know what, I didn't count them all up, but I mean, we could have close to $100 million of bridge loans going out. And to me, that seems like a fairly large risk. So if you could explain how we're funding the bridge loan, how we're mitigating repayment risk, and what has been a horrendous never to happen scenario that equity investors put and can't pay us back, what happens?
So depending on the type of loan, if it's taxable or tax exempt, is going to determine whether or not it gets funded or how it is financed. We do have lines of credit that we use for many of these loans, or we will issue taxable bonds or tax-exempt bonds to make sure we have the right funding, you know, for the project. The multifamily bond issuance that we have, the bond resolution that we have, is a very strong resolution, and the rating agencies stress it to make sure that we have enough liquidity to withstand that kind of a scenario. So every time we do a bond issuance, they're going to rerun that stress test to make sure that we'll be fine. In some cases, if all the deals close at the same time and we have $100 million of outstanding, they will probably require us to put up some collateral, which we've done in the past, more so when the bond resolution was new and was not as strong. We've had to put up collateral, and that's worked, you know, pretty well for us. You know, I agree there is some repayment risk, but we are, we're very much in touch with the developers throughout the whole construction process. It's something that we would know, you know, very early on if there was a problem, and we would continue to work with them. It's very hard to say what market values will be in the future, but we have not... You know, we've never really run into the situation where it doesn't get done and we don't figure out a way to continue to work with the developer.
Right. Again, not to be doomsday, but I've been in a situation a couple of times, you know, now myself. One of my lines of credit was with First Republic Bank, who was $200 billion, you know, I think would go like that. it's banks investing in tax credits, right? It's banks providing us the line of credit. It's banks that are going to be paying our bridge loan. So it's, and they're not in the greatest shape right now. So again, are we doing what we should be doing? Are we getting pay-ins along the way? Are we, is this non-recourse, these bridge loans? What are we?
So the, I can take a stab at that. The bridge loans are recourse. One thing I would note is that on at least two of these, we know that the tax credit investor is going to require that they provide a construction loan at the beginning of construction. So those situations, our construction loan is not going to come in until it's construction is probably 50% done. So to the extent that I really don't think... Some of these are going to close, you know, 12 months, so I do think we're going to be staggering them. I also think that on these two taxable, where we are listed as the construction lender, I'm not going to be surprised if by the time we get to firm that we're no longer the construction lender because of the, you know, the input from the syndicator, whether it's a multi-fund or proprietary fund, they may require that they provide the construction loan. So, but it's certainly something that we talk about.
Do you're concerned that the investor will walk? Is that what you're afraid of?
I think that's it because there's no, the value is not in the real estate.
Mm-hmm.
The value is in the tax credits and the payment for those tax credits. So, yeah. And they're, I think, putting up about 15% and nothing probably until construction completion is the general way. So, we're fully at risk until the project is completed. And
yeah, the one other offset I could think of that could be helpful as we think about it is, given that 15% in, would if another investor had to come in now, you could actually get it at a pretty low cost, you know, because you wouldn't get that much 15% back probably.
Right.
So it would be a higher yield for a new investor to come
right.
in. Which
and how much of a haircut, I guess, is needed? Is it, you know, is it, it's hard to say, but, you know.
Yeah, it depends on what's going on with the project, for sure. If something really went sideways, I think, you know, it would be tough maybe to get a new investor, but typically in a market like this with high CRA need, you probably would now be in the 80s. You know, which would be,
mm-hmm.
I think you'd be able to get a master. So I think it's worth, you know, thinking through, but I do think that helps mitigate that.
Sure.
Whatever we're getting up front
sure.
should help.
Okay. And assume that HUD doesn't overlay its requirements on it for in terms of equity pay-ins if we're doing HUD risk share.
No, this is Anne again. Because with these deals, we don't ensure the loan until the bridge loan is paid off and we're ready to convert
right.
to amortization.
Right, so it's all on us during that time. Okay. Stephen, happy to have you here.
Thank you. Appreciate it. My pleasure.
Just like to note for the record that Commissioner Stephen Pryor has joined the meeting.
Perfect. Thank you, Tim. And we're just jumping in to item number two, which was Central Street Development, if you happen to have any questions about that
Thank you.
Particular transaction. Any other comments or questions about this? No.
I only have one question. I think it's sort of a broader question that maybe pertains to all the deals, and you alluded to it when you were talking about the balancing of the budgets. Just on the cost side, I think that's the biggest thing that we all worry about right now, right? The interest rates are built in to these deals, right? So that's good. We don't have to, you know, I don't think they're going to go up too much more, it seems. So potentially, we're better than we were on deals a year ago. Construction costs, I'm hearing, have not gone down, is what I've heard, but they're maybe moderating a little bit. Insurance, I'm hearing, it's been a problem.
Yeah.
So I guess I just wonder, like, as we look at so many deals, how do you all get comfortable with, like, the costs are, you know, of course, we're not going to get everything nailed down because it's still early, but then how do you protect against upside? And I know it's probably a hard question, but any thoughts on that?
And again, it's a great question, and we were talking about this early. Because this was a competitive process, our ability to sort of have conversations with the developers was limited, right, because we wanted to be transparent and treat everybody the same. So those conversations will happen in earnest once these are approved. In terms of the interest rate, I would say there's a hedge on virtually every single one of the rates that you'll see in the reports, in these credit committee write-ups. In terms of construction costs, our design and construction team has looked at all of the ones that are moving forward. You know, based on our most recent data, they seem reasonable and consistent. I think the challenges on construction are less around cost these days and these just sort of oddball supply chain issues that folks are running into. So it's up to the development team to kind of mitigate and make sure that they're, you know, once a project is ready to move forward, that they're being really thoughtful and ordering stuff ahead of time, and our team is being somewhat flexible about making sure that, you know, we can pay for stuff ahead of time to make sure that it's here, even if it's, you know, they're not ready to you know, put the windows in, but they know they've got them when they are. Insurance, you know, we spend a lot of time with our asset management folks reviewing the operating expenses. We have definitely seen increases in insurance. I think we just, you know, we've got a database of information, and we just have to sort of work through all of that as part of the situation. So I wish I could say that these numbers aren't going to change between now and firm commitment, but I don't really think that's a fair statement.
Okay. But the good news is we have our eyes open on this now, too, where some of these things caught us by surprise, everyone in the industry historically. So, and then also, what is the per unit cost on this again?
You mean the maximum?
It, I guess, for new construction and preservation separately. For this deal. Yep. For new construction, it's $433,000, and for preservation, it's $184,375 per unit.
And collectively, it's about $327 a unit, which is very reasonable.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you.
Any other questions about this one?
I would just state, this is James Comer, to both of your concerns, certainly on the equity side and also on the construction side as well, one of the benefits to being Rhode Island and being small is we deal with a smaller universe of folks, and we have built up relationships over many years with syndicators, investors, lenders, contractors, and by and large, we work with a quarter of folks for many of these deals that we have trust in and that have proven in the past very willing to work with us in the case of a difficult project. We obviously are not anticipating difficult projects, but it does give us some comfort to understand that we know the players for the most part, and that we have decades of relationships in most cases working through challenges.
Great. Yeah. Thank you.
Take a
Corinne speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending approval of reservation of low-income housing tax credits and preliminary approval of financing for Central Street development in Pawtucket and Central College, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. With that, we have a unanimous approval. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Now I'd like to move to agenda item number 3, which is recommendation for approval of reservation of low-income housing tax credits and preliminary approval of financing. Rosebrook Commons, located in Middletown. Question on this one?
Sarah, make a motion.
Thank you, Sarah. Oh, okay, I'll second this one then, please. And
Stephanie,
come
again.
Presenting this one again, please.
Yes.
Thank you.
Stephanie Booker here to present this request for action for preliminary approval of 2023 9% low-income housing tax credits and preliminary approval for our RI Housing taxable construction loan in an amount not to exceed $11,895,000, of which $3,659,000 will remain as a permanent first mortgage, and Home Investment Partnership Program loan in the amount of $1 million for Rosebrook Commons. Methuselah Development Corporation is the developer. Rosebrook Commons is a mixed-income, mixed-use development located in Middletown, Rhode Island. The development consists of two buildings containing a total of 64 residential units and 23,000 square feet of commercial space on the ground floor. Of the 64 units, 51 will be LIHTC units, while the remaining 13 will be middle-income units with rents up to 120% AMI. Of the LIHTC units, 13 will be affordable to households with incomes below 30% of area median income, while 38 will be affordable to households with incomes below 60% of AMI. The unit sizes range from 1 to 3 bedrooms. The developer has requested HPF ELI funds to provide operating support for the 30% AMI units. The commercial space will be financed separately and is not reflected in the sources and uses. The commercial component will be separated from the housing by a condominium agreement. The entire development has been granted comprehensive permit and final plan approval was received from the Middletown Planning Board on January 9, 2023. Michael Associates LTD is the proposed investor. The price per credit is lower than what we are typically seeing at 89 cents per credit. We will require the borrower to bid out to investors to secure a more competitive price. The first equity installment is currently set at 15%. In addition, the remaining capital stack will include a middle-income program loan and develop a housing two funds. Happy to answer any questions.
Oh, I did that backwards, didn't I? No? All right. Oh, I already asked for a motion on that one. Okay.
You did. You got a motion. Good.
Comments or questions?
Is there not a syndicator identified yet?
Yeah, Michael.
Identified Michael Associates. The pricing was a little lower than what we would have anticipated, so we would like them to go out to bid.
The financing, is that in place for the 23,000 square feet of commercial?
Currently, they are working with a lender.
Okay. Any intended users? Or?
So they have some services within the development itself that will be utilizing some of that space. They have not identified other renters yet.
The only thing I would add to that is this developer has a lot of experience with both affordable multifamily as well as commercial development, so we're not too concerned at this point that they won't be able to lease that.
Okay, great. And and this is more of a general question, but for the DAH2 funds and the middle income program funds, are those both grant programs, or are there repayment terms for those?
They are. Everything will be a loan to ensure that it's in basis, and we will require that 50% of the cash flow come back to probably the DAH2 funds, which would be, depending on the order. But I think we put the DAH2 funds at the top, since those would serve below 80% AMI units.
And then the middle income, would that be the same, or?
Mm-hmm. So it's 50% of cash flow until they pay back the first soft loan, and then it's 50% of the cash flow until they pay the next one, so.
Okay.
But they're both structured as long-term loans.
Yeah.
0% interest. Okay. Are they due on sale, or?
Yes, their maturity date will be either 30 or 40 years, depending on the term of the first mortgage, and they would be due upon either the earlier of maturity or the sale of the property or the refinance.
Okay, great. Thank you. I just had another one. This is a bridge loan, and again, not necessarily specific to this one. Just throw it out, or actually ask a question. So do we have requirements or not requirements really, but guidelines for payment of developer fee on deals, and is that altered in the cases where we're putting in such large bridge loans?
This is Anne again. So typically we're limiting the first payment up to 20 or 25% of the total fee. In some cases, when they get the 50% completion, assuming Everything is going according to plan. There may be another release of developer fee. This is typically more for some of the nonprofits. No more than 50% would go out at, in total at 50% completion, and the balance then comes in at the end, or gets paid at the end.
So that's our standing policy, and it's, it doesn't change in face of the bridge loan when there might not be any equity coming in during construction?
It might be a little bit less than 25%, but that's, I will tell you that's a change. I mean, for many, many years, it was 50% got paid at closing, so we have ratcheted back. I think it's a challenge, and it's many of our developers are nonprofits, and they count on that initial payment to keep going.
Understood. I'm just thinking that's just another leverage point, especially if they don't have any network. The recourse provisions don't mean much. So here's some money that we can say, okay, make sure you deliver, and we'll give it to you.
And this is it. I think that's why we're been limiting it to 20 or 25% at the beginning.
Okay.
I have one quick question. Just with the mixed income, so housing, I know we've got quite a few deals that have been incorporating middle-income housing, which is awesome. Are we seeing any slowness in lease-up of those units, or are they going quickly in the mixed income scenario?
That's a good question. I would say it depends on the developer. And I say that because we've had some developers that I think are a little bit more comfortable and familiar with the process around advertising for units like that, and then we have a developer or two who are sort of unfamiliar with that kind of marketing in that territory, and it might be a little harder for them. But you know, our asset management team is available to assist with them sort of on the income eligibility piece and guide them for that.
Okay, and amenity-wise, do you find they need to have more amenities, or does it make a difference?
I would say that sometimes we're seeing sort of a higher level of amenities. I will note that in a couple of instances, even for projects that are 100% LIHTC or below 80%, from a long-term durability perspective, we're seeing developers want to come in with solid surfaces as opposed to laminate. The cost difference up front isn't that significant, but they, over the long term, they don't have to replace them as much. And so some would say that's a market rate amenity. Some of them are looking to put like the silver skin on the appliances because the black or the white doesn't really cost any more, but it looks fancier.
Mm-hmm. And gyms and just benefits like that I think are good for everybody, so hopefully.
Yeah, there's not any, sorry, this is James Comer, there's not any restrictions on accessing amenities between the different income bands. It's not something that we would accept.
Perfect. Which is great. Okay. Thank you.
Sarah Seven, any questions or comments? Okay. Would you please take a vote?
Speaking, commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending approval of a reservation of low-income housing tax credits and preliminary approval of financing for Rosebrook Commons in Middletown, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay.
Excuse myself.
Okay. Thank you. With two affirmative votes and one recusal, the motion is approved.
Thank you, Corinne. I'd now like to move on to agenda item number 4, which is the recommendation for approval of reservation of low-income housing tax credits and preliminary approval of South Point Commons, located in Westerly. And I believe, Jeff, you're going to introduce this one for us.
That's correct. This is Jeff Swanson. Compared to many of the deals we see, frankly, this one's incredibly straightforward. It's the proposed new construction of 72 units in Westerly, Rhode Island. The developer is Dakota Partners, who's done a handful of deals with Rhode Island Housing at this point. The 72 units will be located in two garden-style buildings, 57 of the 72 units will be affordable. In addition to the equity generated from the sale of these 9% LIHTC credits, the project will receive a variety of ancillary funding sources to complete the capital stack. We're here today to ask that you, approve our request for $1.2 million in 9% credits. To the best of our knowledge, all underwriting at this point conforms to our standards.
Thank you very much, Jeff. I have a motion to approve agenda item number 4.
So moved.
Sarah, did you give me one? Motion's been moved and seconded. Any comments or questions?
Yes.
Stephen, please.
Stephen Pryor. There are 15 market rate units in the complex. No objection on that notion. How do we, in our evaluation process, give credit for or discount market rate in a complex, and how does our QAP account for the inclusion of obviously incorporating market rate features?
This is Ann. So there are points in our, this was a 9% deal,
yep.
And we do provide points for units that are above or not low-income housing tax credits, so typically above 80% AMI. We do obviously want to make sure that the rents are commensurate with the market. In the case of this developer, we often see that their market rate rents are actually a little bit below market to give them a little bit of a cushion, but they are unrestricted, and as we talked before, the units are integrated throughout the development, so one doesn't look any different from the other, and all of the finishes are the same. Does that answer your question?
It does, and at the very top of your answer, you expressed that the units are taken into account in our evaluative system. How? Just could you repeat your point on that? The market rate units?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Do we have, so we there are features of QAP that speak to efficiency of subsidy use and productivity in effect.
Yes.
The market rate units count?
Yes. Yes. So the overall efficiency is per residential unit, not per affordable unit, when we're looking at the overall total development cost.
Okay.
And in this particular case, the developer is carrying debt north of $4 million. So some of the debt, obviously, is being carried by those market rate units.
I'd just like to jump in,
please,
on that one. So there is a total maximum score one can achieve, and there is a section where they can get points if they provide market rate units. And that goes to our public policy that it's good to have a range of incomes in a development while understanding that they will lose tax credit equity by
right.
doing so. So to kind of compensate for that, I can't remember how much, might be 10 points or something like that.
Thank you.
Sure.
In this project specifically, some of the LIHTC units, they've achieved three different tiers of affordability. There's 15 units, I believe, that are at 30%, and then that's, let's see if I can do this in my head, 42 units that would be at 60%, and then the 15 unrestricted. So we are seeing not just two tiers, but a multiple tiers in a lot of our projects right now.
May I ask another question?
Oh, sure.
On the fee that is being considered for this particular deal, there's fee structure overall, and there's the deferred fee. The deferred fee is de minimis in this case. How do we decide what's fair and appropriate on the deferred fee feature?
So, just James Comer, if I can, it's really just a function of what makes the deal work. And if there is a gap that needs to be filled, and the developer has to step in with that deferred fee, we work through that with them. It's on a deal-by-deal basis. We do have an overall policy for how to calculate developer fee, so that's fair and equitable across the deals. But in this case, it would just be, again, everybody working together to get the deal, the capital stack finished, and the deal for us to finish up.
Do you consider different trade-offs as to non-deferred fee versus other ways of ensuring value in the pro forma?
Sure. I mean, it's always a balancing act, and it's just a function of what is the developer doing to make it worthwhile? What kind of cost reductions can they put into place? And it's something that we work out, and oftentimes we work out as the deal goes on. And if they can bring other resources to the table, that defer fee can get reduced. There are instances where sometimes after approval, even funds will come in to offset some of the gap, and then we can adjust the deferred fee accordingly.
On this particular point, I'm just interested in how we equitably treat fee across deals. Equity is not the only factor, by the way. Getting mm-hmm. the deal done is a key factor. So I would love to, at some point, do a sidebar. Need not be in a formal
sure.
meeting.
We can also share the policy for how we calculate developer fee and how that's administered with you as well.
Very much appreciate that.
Great.
I'll throw out a few questions. This is a very coin deal. Nice to see some of these every now and then. Like it too. Underwrite them. Is there a lender line up?
They are exploring a variety of options. Their application note did include and I confess I don't have the name in front of me, but I can send it to you later. But their application included both construction and permanent financing LOIs, as well as I should point out that there were syndicator LOIs for the pricing, but they have reserved the right to go back to the market for their syndicator to firm things up.
Okay. And the geotech report, has that been completed on this project?
That's after we, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, had a number of deals where there were, frankly, problems during construction. We require it up front as part of our application process. And part of the review, quite frankly, is has the geotech findings been reflected in the construction budget? Have they actually used the information? So
the case here?
Yes.
Okay. We think so.
Yes.
Okay. I'm not too familiar with that, but I assume there might be a lot of sand and water down there, I think. Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't have any other questions myself.
I don't.
Okay. Great. Corinne, would you please take a vote on this one for us?
Happy to. This is Corinne speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending approval of the reservation of low-income housing tax credits and preliminary approval of financing for South Kent Commons in Westerly, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, say nay. It appears the motion is approved by a unanimous vote.
Thanks, Chris.
Now let's move on to agenda number 5, which is recommendation for
preliminary approval of financing for Reynolds Farms Senior Housing Phase 2, located in North Kingstown. And Jeff, you'll be presenting this one, please.
Yes, this is Jeff Swanson again. So this is a 4% deal. The first three were 9% deals. And again, this project is relatively straightforward. It's 40 units of 55-plus housing in North Kingstown. The developer in this case is Valley Affordable Housing Corporation. Phase 1 was completed about 2 years ago, and these projects are nearly identical, so we have some wonderful data points. Rhode Island Housing will issue tax-exempt bonds to issue the 4% low-income housing tax credit, which will also be our bridge loan. In addition to the equity generated from the sale of the credits, this project will receive a variety of ancillary funding sources to complete the capital stack. And we've touched on this already, but the underwriting conforms to the Rhode Island housing standards, with the exception of the bridge loan test. And again, the amount of bonds that we will issue is be only slightly above the minimum required by the IRS. We will require the developer to also execute a construction completion guarantee, which will make that loan recourse to help mitigate the exposure. And that's kind of about it for formal comments, if anyone has any questions.
I have a motion to approve recommendation for preliminary approval of financing for Reynolds Farm Senior Housing 2. Thank you, Sarah.
Second.
Thank you, Maria. Any comments or questions about this particular one? Yes, Stephen.
This one, curious about the permanent loan at 200K. Is that all this sustained question?
As much as kind of, I'll answer the second question first. We probed it. This is Jeff Swanson. we probed as much as we were able and referenced that we had very limited opportunity to have discussions with the applicants in an effort to keep, you know, to evaluate the applications on their own merits. So we will continue to explore that, but we believe, at least currently, the answer is yes. With the increase we've seen with insurance and operating expenses in all units in this project being affordable, there is very little in the way of cash flow available to support debt service. And that's been, traditionally, that's what we've seen, is this is almost a cookie-cutter deal for the deals that we've done of this size in the past. They've been all around 40 units, and they can support very little at 100% affordable units. They can support very little in the way of debt.
Just to hone in a little bit on your point about communicating with the applicants, first of all, I want to commend you on getting this much done. So just know in the context of this is a magnificent stack, there's a lot that we're going to get done as a result of your great vetting and work. But on the communication with the applicants, I'd love to hear more, not at this exact moment, Chair, to you all. I don't want to delay proceedings, but there has to be a way to find a happy medium that's perfectly principled, where we can ask maybe all the applicants if your permanent debt is a modest component of the mix, please explain.
So if I could jump in.
Yeah, please.
You know, that is part of our underwriting. We do size the debt appropriately. Yeah. This is a senior building. Folks on fixed incomes, 11 of these units are for folks making under 30% of area median income. And frankly, this is the second phase. We have Reynolds Farm 1 as data to draw on. And we, you know, that also backstops our calculations. You know, if the concern is that folks aren't borrowing enough or not, we're over-subsidizing a deal, I think that, yeah, as you see going forward, we underwrite these deals very well. It's not a question of us not communicating with the borrower, with the applicant. We do have a lot of communication with them. At a certain point, though, there's just not enough. There's just not any more money you can get out of the project in this particular case. That's why you're looking at a low mortgage.
Okay, great. And I was responding to the point that challenging to communicate more. So sounds like, James, you were satisfied, but maybe there was room at some level for, nonetheless, a little bit more dialogue. So just for future discussion.
Yeah, well, this is Jeff Swanson. Certainly, as we have some additional data points in the way of the market study and the appraisal to, you know, see what, to confirm what their underwriting rents are really realistic, we'll be looking at that. The application includes the pro forma, which has a 30-year cash flow. We look at it through year 15, and right now with our negative trending assumptions in year 15, they're at a 1.2 debt service coverage in year 15. So that's kind of what we look at as our litmus test to see if it's sized appropriately. They start off quite a bit higher, but the negative trending takes its toll. Maybe Ann or Dean has some.
There's limited NOI. We're pretty confident that this is all they can afford.
Yeah, so this is for another data point. That's pretty common that we'll see on our deals where there's a lot of 30% units that kind of have a lot of for that. And from the investor standpoint, it'd be hard to get an investor if it's too leveraged.
Yeah.
So it's very common just from a data point.
Thank you.
I'm going to follow up on that question. Could you give some insight maybe to operating expenses and where this one sits relative to what you see out there, comparable type properties, and then also maybe how Reynolds Farm 1 is performing?
Sure. Michael DiCaro. So this is an easy one because we have Reynolds Farm 1, so we have a significant amount of data in our portfolio of how our properties operate. So we typically look at, we have two phases. We look at other deals that this developer or this management company have in the state, compare the proposal to that, as well as looking at a sample of similar properties, right? Similar number of units, similar location, and this falls right in line. I think the, generally speaking, for the entire portfolio, our typical operating cost, the average operating cost is just under $10,000, including everything. Barrel Farm 1 comes out like $8,600, this one's underrated at $8,200. Or in that zone, and we often remove taxes and utilities from the computation because they're uncontrollable expenses for the most part. And looking at those numbers, rental fund one, this is 300 a unit, this one's 6270, so they're very similar.
Okay. So this falls well within the range,
absolutely,
what you've seen. Okay. And then maybe just a follow-up, what is the, could you speak to the capacity and experience of the sponsor of this particular one?
Sure, I'll take a stab at that. This is Ann Berman. Valley Affordable, they have completed more than a handful of transactions with Rhode Island Housing over the past 25 years. They have an identity and interest management company that manages their own portfolio as well as some third party. I would say that we put medium as a risk here, specifically because the executive director of this nonprofit is probably looking at retirement in the next few years. And so from a succession planning perspective, and we did sort of probe that question with them, you know, they have an experienced board, they have a lot of staff on their management company. So we're comfortable with them as a developer, but we just wanted to note that perhaps there's a little bit more risk here than there is with some of our other developers.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll just add, it's Michael DiCaro again, that their management company is very proactive when it comes to making sure that their rents are in line with the current market rents, or current 60% rents, as opposed to, you know, we've seen cases in the past where others don't look at rent increases for a number of years, so they're very thoughtful.
No other comments or questions, correct?
Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending preliminary approval financing for Reynolds Farm Senior Housing Phase 2 in North Kingstown, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. The motion is approved by unanimous vote.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll now move on to agenda item number 6, which is recommendation for preliminary approval financing for Broad Street Home located in Central Falls. And Seth, are you going to take this one, please?
Yes.
Thank you.
This is Seth St. Jean. Good morning. The project is Broad Street Homes and the developers One Neighborhood Builders. The request for a preliminary commitment of a tax-exempt construction loan totaling $11 million and a taxable permit loan of $825,000. Broad Street Homes is located in Central Falls and is proposing the creation of 47 affordable units on three approximate lots, consisting of a former police station, a blighted former Dunkin' Donuts, and a municipal parking lot. I will add, Dunkin' Donuts will be demolished ultimately in the project. There's a development agreement between the City of Central Falls and One Neighborhood Builders that designated them as an exclusive developer for these properties. This was signed in February of 2022. Units will range from 30 to 60% of area median income, with 6 units at 30% of AMI. Bedroom sizes range from efficiency of the 3 bedrooms, and for the 30% units, the development is being recommended for HPF ELI funding to capitalize an operating reserve to cover the difference between the 30% rents and the 50% rents. Preliminary total development cost is approximately $20.1 million or $428,000 per unit. Less reserves, that goes down to $420,000 per unit. The syndicator is NEF and is projecting 93 cents per credit, which is similar to pricing that we've seen on other deals. I will say the first equity installment is at 20%, and they are going to get another equity installment at 50% completion. So we, you know, have a little more coming in during construction there. They also withhold the right to go back out to the market for the syndicator, but for now this is what they have projected. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Okay, a motion
to approve preliminary financing for Broad Street Homes.
Sarah.
So you're going to recuse yourself. Got it. You've got a lot of potential business here. All second. Any comments or questions about this one? I think it is. I'll jump in. I think it's a really interesting project. They're all interesting, but I think that this one should, I think, help really energize the area immediately around City Hall there, take care of some blighted structures. Was that a historic structure too? The old?
Yeah, we believe the former police station is a historic structure. Yeah.
I think that's interesting. Okay. I really didn't have any other questions myself about it. An easy one. Okay.
This is Corey speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending preliminary approval of financing for Broad Street Homes in Central Falls, please say aye.
Aye.
With two affirmative votes and one refusal, the motion is approved. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Karen. Let's jump to item number 7, which is recommendation for preliminary approval of financing for
Hattie Bethune House.
Hattie Bethune. Okay. House in Portsmouth. I'm going to butcher that, I'm sure.
Stephanie.
Stephanie Booker here to present this request for action for preliminary approval of a Rhode Island housing tax-exempt construction loan in an amount not to exceed $10,248,000, of which $3.2 million will remain as a permanent first mortgage, and a home loan of $1 million and a trust fund loan of $1 million for Addie Bethune Development in Portsmouth. The developer is Church Community Housing Corporation. Addie Bethune House consists of a single building with 54 units of affordable age-restricted housing and a new senior center. There are 6 one-bedroom units at 30% AMI, while the remaining 34 one-bedroom and 14 two-bedroom units are proposed at 60% AMI. CCHG has requested HPF ELI funds for operating support for the 6 one-bedroom units for households with incomes below 30% AMI. The town of Portsmouth will lease the land to CCHC for 99 years, and at completion, will purchase the senior center for $1 million. There will be a shared parking lot and amenities. I'd like to note, too, though, that this was the 4th highest scoring 9% application, but they were also very competitive at 4%. In addition to the remaining capital stack, this is comprised of capital magnet fund loan, a development affordable housing 2 fund, and proceeds from the sale of the senior center to the town of from the town of Portsmouth. The investor is National Equity Fund. The price per credit is 92 cents, and the first equity installment proposed is 20%. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Stephanie. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved. Maria Berry.
Thank you, Maria.
Second.
Thank you, Sarah. Any comments or questions about this one? Stephanie, I know we went over this. I think it was on a tax credit review committee, but could you just explain this transaction with the senior center, how it's being built or financed and then sold, I guess, to the city?
So it is part of the capital stack that we're proposing, and the town will actually just purchase the senior center and then lease the land.
So how is it? Is it tax credits can pay for this, or?
They're going to borrow, this is Ann Berman, so part of their construction financing will cover the cost of the construction of the senior center, and then
okay, so it's just a short-term debt.
Yeah, it's a turnkey project, yeah.
Okay. Looks like a fantastic site.
It's a great site.
Yeah. I don't have any other.
I just had a quick question. Who's the executive director for church?
Christian Belden.
Belden, okay.
He's been there about 15 years, and he's been executive director for about the past 4 or 5.
Okay. And the financial strength of the organization?
You know, I think it's pretty good. They do some fee-for-service. They're the... they do a lot of work for the municipalities. They manage their CDBG application funds. They run a home repair program for all of the cities and towns, so they do earn some fee that way. You know, I think it's, as a nonprofit, they've got a pretty good balance sheet.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. No other comments or questions. Corinne, would you please take a vote?
Yes, this is Corey speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending preliminary financing for Addie Bethune House in Portsmouth, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. The motion is approved with 3 affirmative votes.
Great. Thank you very much, Corinne. We'll now move to item number 8, which is recommendation for preliminary approval of financing for Potter's Tigray Apartments in Providence. And thank you, Jeff.
This is Jeff Swanson. Potter's Tigre contains two distinct components, and it's being developed by SWAMP, which has been very active over the years in this neighborhood. Potter's Avenue is 37 existing apartments located on scattered sites in South Providence. These units, on a unit-by-unit basis, will undergo a light to moderate rehab. Developer projects spending about $96,000 per unit on the rehab component. SWAMP also owns or controls now 11 vacant infill parcels that is in the same area as Potter's Avenue. They are proposing to construct new housing units on those 11 parcels. Units will be building size will be 1 to 3 units, depending on the exact parcel, total of 20 new units. These components will be owned and combined by a new limited partnership consolidated into a single economic unit. Rhode Island Housing will issue the tax-exempt bonds to generate the credits. In addition to the LIHTC credits, this project will receive a variety of ancillary funding sources. I think we've talked about the bridge loan quite a bit. The underwriting conforms with that exception. And with that, I'll be happy to answer questions.
Can a motion to approve?
So moved, Maria Berry.
Thank you, Sarah. Any comments, questions? Broke you out at you. This is another project that is only able to support a limited amount of hard debt, I think $500,000. Has that been scrubbed and need to be accurate?
Yes.
Okay. Is the I'm gonna throw this out to you, Michael. Is the design of 2 units per building for the new construction, is that something feasible going forward, or has that been something you've seen to be problematic in maintaining a reasonable level of operating expenses over time?
Certainly miss out on economies of scale. They have been units like 300,000, certainly operating expenses would be high.
Do you have a sense of $1,000 more a unit? Or
I have to dig it a little deeper.
It's about the
one story number.
Yeah.
I mean, I can tell you that these are around 11,000.
These are what? Okay. And if our norm is in that 9 to 10, so it's 1 to 2,000 a unit per year higher? Okay, and then it also looks like they're looking to spend close to $100,000 a unit for renovation of the existing. And when were those either constructed or the last major rehab of those?
About 17 years ago. It's a post-15-year project. Two of the buildings in that are historic and so have been, you know, renovated a number of times, converted. The others, I believe, were constructed 17 years ago.
Yeah.
But, okay. Yes, and I think that's a fair statement. I would say these are family units. As you know, there's not a lot of capital during operations to make, you know, to do a whole scale upgrade. So these, you know, that there were wood siding, I think they're probably now going to get hardy plank. You know, the units are tired.
Yeah.
You know, they've served well, and they, I think SWAMP wants to make sure they're around for another 30 years.
I'd say they're the most attractive in the neighborhood. You drive there, and they really are very well maintained.
Yeah, the original tax credit deal transformed that area tremendously.
Yeah.
It was a great project.
It really did. So I don't want my comments to be misconstrued. I think they're beautiful. It's just a question of how can we make them, I think, more financially feasible and sustainable over time.
Right.
Yes.
And if there's a way maybe to get larger buildings or, again, with certain construction materials, I think is really smart. Okay. And again, the same comments about the bridge loan. So we'll
see that
process.
Yeah.
Maria?
I just have two quick questions. Yeah. Do you have a question?
No.
Go ahead. Two quick questions. So if you have a scattered site like this, how do you provide any services to the residents? Like, how does that work? I know SWAP's got a great presence in that area, so is it more through their centralized, or how does that work?
Sure, I'll take a stab at that. I think the short answer is yes. Depending on location, I think there are opportunities to do larger scale buildings, but you know, when you're working in some of these urban neighborhoods, you have these small lots with small footprints, and you know, oftentimes they're pretty unattractive if they're vacant or they have lighted buildings on it. So while it might not be the most efficient execution from a kind of a new production standpoint, you know, when you can do, you know, have a building that might be 24 units in one building, I think it's appropriate for the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a bit of a balancing act. And to James's point, these developments, you know, have been in South Providence and Olleyville and the West End, and they really have transformed the neighborhood. From a service perspective, it definitely makes it a little bit harder, but I think SWAP has a presence on Pine Street, and they are very engaged with their residents. They do provide whatever services that they can. There's also another building around the corner at on Broad Street, so they actually have, I think, a couple of offices.
That's great. That's great. Well, I think there's something really nice about having these two families too. It almost feels like a house, right?
Right.
And
yeah.
So that's, and it is beautiful. And I think as long as they can get the help they need, but I do feel good about the fact that SWAP is really, you know, connected. Like that's their area.
Fair.
So
that's
not like they have to travel so far to
right.
get service. And then one other question I had too is just in the sense of what are you seeing for vacancy rates typically in these developments? I know we underwrite at 7%.
Very low, like we're at about 2 or a little less than 2.
That's what I figured. So that does automatically give you some cushion.
Right. Yeah. And I would add that I think we would feel comfortable underwriting at 5 if the syndicators who are pushing us to underwrite at 7.
Yeah,
because that's a... And the wait list typically for one of these is how many people, like...
I'll defer to Mike, but I reviewed it as part of the application, and it really differs by unit size. One of the other factors I was going to mention is that if you look at average unit size in this portfolio, there's a lot of threes and even some four-bedroom units, so the wait list for those units is 2 to 3 years, is my understanding. Studios and ones is still probably a year plus throughout the portfolio. It seems to be fairly consistent among our multiple CDCs, and really depends more on the area. Operating and unit size.
Pretty much in all cases, a long waiting
list. The demand has not been a problem, I think, across the board when we've looked at these applications. Is there demand? That's unfortunately, that's not a big question for these projects.
The more units, the better. That's great.
So are the units that are being rehabilitated in this project, are they already occupied?
Fully occupied.
Okay. Great. Here now. Corinne, would you please take a vote on this one?
You're in favor of recommending preliminary approval of financing for Potter's Two-Way Apartments in Providence. Please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Motion is approved with 3 affirmative votes. Thank you.
I'm moving on to agenda item number 9, which is recommendation for preliminary approval of financing for the
I am. Stephanie and I were lucky. Many of our projects rose to the top to get funded. This has some similarities to the project we discussed. The developer is One Neighborhood Builders, and it does contain two significant components. The first operating component is known as Elmwood Neighborhood Revitalization 2. Inside this building, it's usually called ENR2, and this is similarly a post-15-year project which contains 46 units on scattered sites, but this time in the Elmwood neighborhood. Similarly, these units will undergo a light to moderate rehab. Not coincidentally, this one's just north of $100,000 per unit. But here's where it differs. The other new component is a single building of new construction located at 434 Atwells Avenue. This is anticipated to be a five-story building with some project amenities and a couple of small retail spaces on the ground floors, and then 39 new residential units located on floors 2 through 5. Similar to the other deal, these two components will be combined into a new limited partnership, consolidated into a single economic entity. We'll also issue 4% bonds to generate the housing credits, and unsurprisingly, they're going to receive this variety of other ancillary financing to complete the capital stack. Also, this one conforms to all of our underwriting standards, with the exception of the bridge loan test.
I have a motion to approve.
Make a motion.
Thank you, Sarah. Any comments or questions about this one? This one we saw before. This one, right?
This was the second or third time, I believe, they've applied. It's the first time I personally have reviewed it.
So this project did receive Capital Magnet and Preservation last June.
Yes.
They also received an award of BHRI last spring.
Okay. And
this funding completes their capital.
Okay.
Do you have a breakout between the cost of the acquisition rehab and then the new construction?
So as we said, that the $105,000 is anticipated on the construction of the existing.
The total development cost.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't have that in front of me.
Okay.
It's a print screen on my pro forma.
And then this one also has of the 39 new units, 17 of those are about 40 or 50%. They're going to be up to 80% AMI?
They are. The slight difference with this one is that they are going to be income restricted, just above the 60% AMI tax credit program.
At 80% AMI?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
80%, okay. And that, I guess you look at it one way, maybe as a developer, you say, oh my God, I'm losing a lot of tax credit equity by doing that. But obviously we have this middle income program, I guess, to slip in there to subsidize that. It looks like a great location. It looks like a great range of incomes. So this is I'm just curious, though. It seems like putting a fair amount of middle income maybe into one project, and what was the kind of the rationale of doing that versus maybe spreading it around?
The middle income is based on the number of units, and I think they did that for a variety of reasons. One is it made it more competitive as a 9% deal, although they ended up ultimately submitting as a 4% deal. I think they also thought about it from a neighborhood perspective and from a debt perspective.
Okay, so it's 20% of the units, is that it, have to be?
In order to meet the middle income, at minimum of 20% of the units have to be affordable below 100% of AMI. So it's going to be very important that these units rent at the 80% AMI. They could potentially go a little higher if they wanted to, as long as they're 10% below market, which is also a requirement under the middle income program.
To
your point, Kevin, though, I think it's, we evaluate the program that the developer brings to us. And, in this case, this is what they judged. I think they clearly have done a lot of work. As you noted, they came in previously. They've had some time to discuss with us and really refine what they're doing to get to this point. And they assessed what the neighborhood might need. There's, as we know, vacancy across the board at every income level. No vacancy at any income level across the board in Providence. And, made the decision to apply for certain pots of funding based on what they thought was best for the development.
My other question was very similar to what you said about
So it was better to do the middle income, like, slice versus income averaging. It just, the way the numbers worked, it just worked out better, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry.
That was my core. Thank you.
Yes. Yes, the numbers work better is going to be the short answer.
Yeah. Okay. I know it's a balancing act. There's a big capital, like, a lot of sources here.
Well, and there's some other things. In this case, I know that was very focused that by restricting those units, even though they're not qualifying for LIHTC, they do qualify for the 8% tax application in the city of Providence. So that actually brought their, even though they're giving up a little bit on the income side, it actually increases the NOI by having them be income restricted at that level. Their NOI goes up. What they give up in income, they is like three times what they make up in the reduced taxes. So that equation enters into the puzzle too.
And keeping them restricted.
Keeping them restricted.
How does that keep them restricted?
I believe to have the 8%, they're into perpetuity.
Well, under this program, they're going to be restricted either 30 or 40 years based on the term of the loan.
Great. Okay.
Comments or questions? Would you please take a vote on this one?
Yes, this is Karina speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending preliminary approval of financing for the Avenue in Providence, please say aye.
Aye.
Noting one recusal from Maria Berry and two affirmative votes.
Thank you. We'll now move on to agenda item number 10, which is recommendation for preliminary approval of financing for Summer Street Apartments located in Providence. And Jeff, you got this one.
I do.
Thank you.
Getting tired of putting my arm up, but no.
That's helpful.
So this is Jeff Swanson. Summer Street is not as straightforward as some of the ones we've talked about. This is the proposed new construction of 176 units. The developer is Crossroads, Rhode Island. This project will cater entirely to residents that were homeless or are at risk of becoming homeless. And as they undergo their initial lease up, many of the initial residents will be relocated from the existing Crossroads facility over on Broad Street. This project has appeared before the board previously. They anticipated previously having two different legal owners and using a bifurcated deal structure of 4% and 9%. But as they continue to analyze the deal, the developer actually thought that both the development and operation of the project would be more efficient as a single 4% transaction. So we're back today to sort of represent it in that reconfigured state. So similar to the other deals, in addition to the equity generated from the sale of the credits, they're receiving a wide range of ancillary funding sources. I'll add many of which are not controlled by Rhode Island Housing. They have searched far and wide for sources. Similar to the other deals, this deal conforms to the Rhode Island Housing Standard underwriting with the exception of the bridge loan test. With that, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thanks very much, Jeff. A motion to approve?
I'll make a motion. Sorry.
We can have some questions, though.
Okay. Thank you.
I was sort of anticipating that, as I have my syndicator down as TBD. They included some LOIs, but they are going to the market. So
this is a very, very important project, and a number of organizations have really stepped up to help this. City of Providence, even the our State Energy Grant Fund, it's just, it will be wonderful to see that under construction. I do know that there was previously some neighborhood opposition to this and the concentration of the lower income persons in this neighborhood, and I wondered if you could speak to that. And
sure. I mean, I think anytime there's a project of this magnitude in any neighborhood, you're going to see some folks who are concerned about what that impact might be. This is a massive construction project. It's relocating, a vulnerable population, very, a very short distance, but nonetheless, folks may, expect some upheaval, but I know that Crossroads has done done some work in reaching out to the communities. I know they're committed to being a good neighbor in that part of South Providence, and you know, we expect that they're going to continue to do that as they go through this whole process, which will take a while. So there'll be ample opportunity for them to continue their outreach to the community and have them be part of the process.
This is Jeff, and I can add to that that they've actually taken some of that feedback and incorporated what some of the shortcomings are in their existing facility as well as the feedback, and it's been incorporated into the design elements. So they have a considerably more interior congregation space. They have a specific outdoor courtyard that will be appropriately landscaped and kind of screened and try to give it more of a, you know, less of a parking lot feel, frankly, from where residents hang out now. So I can't speak to the dialogues they've had because I haven't been present, but I know that, that as we've reviewed the plans and specs, they've worked hard to try to incorporate feedback to be good neighbors.
It's good to hear. The bridge test, it says it failed it, but it looked like it might pass that.
This one did better than others, and I actually brought it with me. But
$36 million of tax credit proceeds, and I think it was about a $20 million bridge loan.
Our exposure is not on a percentage basis as high, but unfortunately it does still fail.
Oh, okay. But it was. Yeah, we should look at. I thought it was supposed to be the. What is it? A bridge loan plus the initial equity contribution is not to exceed 90% of the total.
We'll go back and look at it.
Okay.
Well, as silly as it sounds, if they reduce their equity contribution to the minimum of 15%, it probably passes. But the application as presented had 25% of the syndication equity coming in at close, and so that skews it a bit.
Better to receive that.
Which I was going to say, I watched me.
From our risk standpoint.
Watch us not complain, but yeah, that.
Okay. And the tax credit syndicator?
They have talked extensively with NEF and okay. Some other parties. They included an LOI with pricing of 93 cents, but they are, based on the size of this project, hoping to do better than that, frankly, and garner more interest, and so they do plan as they get further down the road to go back to the market and keep their options open, shall we say.
Great. Overall looks like a solid financing structure.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any weak points or anything else that needs to be approved? Or?
No, the money that we're allocating today is actually the last money that they need. This is a RAD 2 conversion, so they have already begun their conversations with HUD, and that process is underway. And, you know, now that it's one transaction instead of two, just paper-wise, it's going to be a lot simpler.
Yeah. And this is Jeff. I can add that we've been actually so busy lately, I was able to do some appraisals that were for in the neighborhood because we wanted to make certain we were underwriting to the lower of the contract or market, and so we've even had some initial data to confirm that the contract rents are well below what we anticipate market rent to be. So this one's even a little further along than many at this stage.
And they received a federal appropriation earmark?
They did. They worked with our local senator, and they have a $2 million direct appropriation from Washington, and they're actually well into the paperwork on that.
I have one question, actually. This is more of a broader question on all these deals. Do you anticipate most of them closing this year, or is there any requirement to break ground at a certain point?
That's a great question. So several of these, particularly those that are sort of one like this that's a little farther along, we're hoping we'll close within the next 6 months, whether it's the end of the quarter four or the beginning of quarter one of 2024, hard for me to say that. I think it still has to be determined. The bulk of these that are getting preliminary commitment have to get confirmed in 9 and close within 12. So I would expect the ones that were really just approving preliminary 4 are likely 12 months away.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there no other comments or questions? Corinne, would you please take a vote?
Yes. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending preliminary approval financing for Summer Street Apartments in Providence, please say aye.
Aye. Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to move on to item number 11, which is recommendation for preliminary approval of financing for Lockwood Plaza Phase 1 located in Providence. And Stephanie,
thank you. Stephanie Booker here presents this request for action for preliminary approval of a Rhode Island housing tax exempt construction loan of up to $11.9 million, of which $3 million will remain as permanent first mortgage for Lockwood Plaza Phase 1 Providence. The developer is Wynn Companies. Phase 1 is the rehabilitation of 108 townhomes. The total development consists of 209 units. Phase 2 will apply for funding in a future round. The townhouse unit mix is a combination of 1, 2, 3, and 4-bedroom units, all at 60% AMI. The scope of work includes interior and exterior upgrades, ADA improvements, and envelope upgrades. Approximately 88% of the units are supported by Section 8 housing choice vouchers and offer affordable housing for residents below 50% and often 30% of AMI. The developer has partnered with Rhode Island Housing and Citizens Bank to create an economic mobility program to support residents and families, build financial capacity, funded by $750,000 of economic opportunity funds from Citizens Bank. In addition, the remaining capital stack is comprised of a capital magnet funds loan, development of affordable housing 2 funds, a loan from the City of Providence, Citizens EOF funds, and a deferred developer fee. This indicator is Boston Financial, and the price per credit is currently at 99 cents, and the first equity installment is set to be at 15%. Happy to answer any questions.
So the first equity installment?
15%.
I'll make a motion.
Thank you.
Second.
Second. Thank you, Maria. Comments or questions about this one? I think I'll jump in. Stephanie, you mentioned the high percentage of housing choice vouchers, I think it was 88%. And for the market studies, do they look at the achievable tax credit rent?
Yes.
Is that as opposed to simply the market rent, but the achievable tax credit?
Yes.
Okay. And so will the loan be underwritten to what then?
It has to be underwritten to the tax credit rent because
they're mobile vouchers.
You can't underwrite the mobile vouchers. I mean, the good news, though, is you know that they're likely to get higher rent, so there's some cash flow there, can deal with a deferred fee, can deal with getting some of our soft debt repaid.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. And it's a 50%? Then 50% of available cash?
Our standard is 50% of available cash. Surplus cash.
I have one question. I think this Economic Opportunity Fund is awesome and really great for the residents. I noticed Rhode Island Housing is part of that too. Do you administer?
So yeah, we have a group here that is our family self-sufficiency group, and they work with, in this case, Wynn was the first partnership we've had, to really partner with a developer and manager to provide greater opportunity for economic mobility for the residents. It's a great pilot, and we're looking to expand it to other things. We do our own family self-sufficiency program within our voucher program, and this is the first time we've been able to partner straightforward with a lending institution.
How does it work?
So I don't want to speak to the specifics of it because I may get it wrong. There's a couple of models. Typically speaking, what will happen is that residents can put money away in escrow, whether that's a portion of their rent payment or whether their any rent increase goes. There's a number of ways to structure it, so I don't want to say exactly how. But basically, the idea is that residents can put a portion of their money that they would otherwise pay for rent into an account that they can then later use for economic mobility purposes, whether that's job training, education. In some cases, it could be for an automobile to get you a job or things like that, activities that will let them and their family kind of build income and progress with their lives.
That's great. And then you manage them like you have the funds here?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Stephen, we're on item number of
thank you for permitting my back and forth.
Oh, great to have you. If you had any questions for that,
repeat which item?
Oh, sure. It's item number 11, which
thank
is
so much.
Lockwood Plaza.
Yeah, I'm okay for right this moment.
Okay,
thank you.
Great. There are no other comments or questions. Corinne, would you take a vote?
Yes, this is Corinne speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending preliminary approval of financing for Lockwood Plaza Stage 1 in Providence, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, say nay. With three affirmative votes, the motion is approved.
Thank you very much, Grant. I'll move to agenda item number 12. And we are more than 50% going. All right. Which is the recommendation for final approval of financing for Copley Chambers 2 and 3 in Providence. And
Caroline.
Presenting this one.
Good morning, everyone. This is Caroline Dialag, and this request for action is for Copley Chambers 2 and 3. The developer is Marathon Development, LLC. We are seeking firm approval of a tax-exempt financing in an amount not to exceed $23 million. $11,719,616 will remain as permanent debt. We are also seeking approval for a capital magnet fund loan of $750,000. Acquisition and revitalization program loan of $2 million, community revitalization program loan up to $2 million, and a development of affordable housing 2 loan up to $500,000. Copley Chambers 2 and 3 will consist of 124 units of affordable housing, 6,800 square feet of commercial space leased to Providence Community Health Center. The dwelling units will be restricted to individuals earning or households earning at or below 30% to 80% AMI. This is a private placement transaction, and Citizens Bank will provide capital for Rhode Island Housing tax-exempt issuance, and Newmark will provide the permanent loan in conjunction with Freddie Mac. Rhode Island Housing will charge a one-time issuer fee of 1% and an annual servicing fee of 25 basis points on the construction and permanent loan. Since preliminary approval, the developer has secured 8 project-based vouchers from Providence Housing Authority. It is of note that the original syndicator withdrew from this transaction, and National Equity Fund has stepped in as the new syndicator, albeit at a lower price per credit, which is 95 cents per credit. The developer has secured an additional $3,818,000 loan from the Providence Redevelopment Agency to fill the gap that was created. The total development cost is under $375,000 per unit, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. So much, Carol.
May I have a motion, please?
So moved. Maria Mary.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you,
Sarah. Any comments or questions about particular transaction? Stephen?
Sure. That was a very helpful explanation. Could you just replay what precipitated the going to the Providence Redevelopment Agency for the arena fraction?
Yes. So they initially had a syndicator with pricing that was quite a bit above market, and that syndicator withdrew from the transaction, and that created a gap. And when the new syndicator stepped in, the pricing is more in line with market pricing that we see for tax credits, and we need to fill the gap, so Providence Redevelopment Agency stepped in.
Got it. Thank you. So the product they're using, do you know, at the PRA?
I'm not sure the name of their loan.
I believe it's their Housing Trust Fund, this bond that they issued.
Got it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Question regarding, it's really the developer fee and the sponsor loan. Do we have I believe I know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do we have and maybe James, you could answer this, do we have a cap on the amount of development per transaction? And also, do we have any cap on the amount of eligible basis that developer fee that can go in?
Yes.
Okay.
The short answer is yes. And so on a tax exempt deal like this, the base developer fee is based on 5% of acquisition and 10% of hard cost. And then in order to generate additional equity that is we require to be deferred back into the deal, they can bring their developer fee up to 15%. And so we do require that they defer the difference. They don't have to go up to 15%. Sometimes it's it doesn't always help them, but in this case, they were able to generate some additional equity, which we require they defer back into the transaction.
So there's no limit on the total developer fee.
It's limited to 15% of the total development.
Right,
cost.
But
it's not a dollar limit; it's a percentage limit.
Correct.
It's a large
correct.
Deal.
Correct.
In this case, it's close to $6 million, which is pretty hefty.
Correct.
And is there any limit to the amount that goes into eligible basis?
No.
Okay. I've seen that in a number of other states, and I'll tap on the absolute developer fee, but also the amount that it goes into, even on a 4% transaction.
Right. Now, in this case, because we limit how much can actually be paid, right, the balance comes out of cash flow, and if they don't generate the cash flow that they, are anticipating, then it becomes debt.
Right, but that's just a deferred fee. But it looks like they went from putting in $3.5 million form of a loan, and now they're taking soft money and not putting any loan in and getting a $4 million paid developer fee if everything works out.
Right.
It just looks like you go from them putting in $3.5 million to them kind of taking out $4 million. And is this over subsidized?
You know, one could say that it was the city that, you know, the $3.5 million sponsor loan is sort of consistent with what the city is putting in. Is it over subsidized? That's a hard question to answer.
Does it look like it needs this many sources to me?
I think this is a very difficult transaction because of the number of moving pieces, and I think that, you know, the developer has, as we've seen with Copley 1 and now 2 and 3, the developer has done a lot of work to get us here and to bring together the groups of folks that are going to make this project a success. I think, you know, it's a different transaction when you look at if they were getting, you know, initially they were getting almost $1.20 in equity, and that's, which, again, we can all understand didn't happen. But I think it speaks to the kind of way that the developer has tried to get this done in every possible way. I think, you know, we can certainly take a look at subsidy levels, but in this case, I think this is the best path forward to get this done.
Yeah, I don't see that it needs all of the subsidy. What? I mean, it's deferring, what, about a third of the fee and $4 million in paid developer fee. And granted, it's a $45 million project.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You get a cost overrun. I mean, you could eat up $2 million of that pretty easily. But going to Stephen's, I think, point earlier, I'd really like to see some guidelines and rails put around the developer fee. And certainly, I think we should look at NCSHA to make sure that we're not putting too much on an eligible basis, and what are some best practices there. But also, I don't mind. Profit, I think, is a great motivator. But when we're putting all of the soft money into it, I think we've got to scrutinize it a bit more and certainly make sure that our soft dollars are being stretched appropriately in order to generate.
Yep.
You know, the housing that we need to do up here. So,
can I just add one thing? And I don't disagree with you at all. I would say that while you're right that at the beginning there was a $3.5 million sp- sponsor loan. When this application came in, I think the developer sort of recognized it was a stretch, and he's sort of a new developer to us, and he was trying, I think, to show, well, I can do this without soft money. The costs have gone up, and I think he sort of recognized that there were opportunities out there for some additional money. You know, this is a vertically integrated company. I do expect that there will be some cost overruns here, and those would come out of.
I think there's a couple things. One is I know that NCSHA will be coming out with some best practice guidelines shortly, and we can certainly look at our policies in line with that and make sure that we're being equitable. I also think we want to make sure that we're being equitable in terms of what we're asking of for-profit developers and nonprofit developers and the different positions that they may have. That there isn't a nonprofit developer that I could think of that would have the ability to do a $3.5 million sponsor loan with their own cash. So we want to make sure that the policy we have, and it's certainly worth reviewing, is meeting everybody where they are and being fair to everyone across the board. And so I think, you know, per your direction, we're happy to take a look at that and we can have a discussion.
Question sure, certainly. Seven, just to affirm Kevin's point, but also to recognize all the hard work that's been done. I'm looking at the mix of investments here, including the state-generated ARP loan. That's our, in effect, light program, bonded for with state resources, highly flexible as to our own deployment. That's a $2 million feature. I'm illustrating here. Is there any way to honor Kevin's point and say, let's see if the project needs it. Let's go to a next level examination of the project. Let's approve it, but make that a springing award if need is demonstrated as the project advances, so that we can reconcile with actual costs as the project proceeds?
I would say we do that with all developments, right? So there's cost certification that we require at the end, and we can certainly hold that to one of the last funding sources that are needed. In this particular case, we're not the senior lender, we may not necessarily be the one dictating all of the terms here, but we can certainly hold some of the funds out until the construction loan has been exhausted and we can see if they're actually needed.
If you feel comfortable with that, and Kevin, you should decide whether that fits the precise point you're making. Maybe we could even make our motion to that effect so that we know we've expressed it that way.
If I can, in my opinion, I don't think we want to get into making a motion that has conditions in that way. What I will say, though, particularly in terms of state dollars, is we have had situations where, due to the cost of the project, we have not expended all of, in the case I'm thinking of, BHRI dollars. And so we then have those dollars left to use for other projects. The same would be true in the scenario they discuss is for ARC, where if they are the last dollars in and we don't need to expend them all because there's been some cost savings, then we can recapture those dollars for
which is good practice.
Yeah.
Good practice and a good explanation. I defer to the committee chair. I'm comfortable. It's your point. But I think there is, in this particular scenario, room for something that allows for a springing addition or a contingency feature or just a delineation of what James and Angel said. Just up to you, Mr. Chair.
I appreciate that. As an option, I think, Stefan, I don't think that what you're presenting would be the same as what you're proposing, though. I think that you're saying that you're going to hold it off to the end, but you're going to give it to them nonetheless.
If they need it. Right. If at the end of the day.
So what if they come in just like it's proposed here? Is that they need it? Or would this? Okay.
Yeah.
So I think you're proposing it, if costs were to go up maybe about $2 million or so, then they need it. But I think what you're saying is they need it based on the presentation here.
So, correct. Yeah, I think.
In that case, I would not vote in favor of this because I think it's oversubsidized. And I would ask you for other deals to really look hard at the amount of subsidy going in. per transaction and whether it's needed. I think this is a good $1 to $2 million overfunded.
And your suggestion would be that it comes out of the developer fee, Kevin? I just want to be clear where you think.
Yeah, I would reduce the R for community revitalization or some other funding program by $1 to $2 million, and I think, I'd take it right out of the developer fee. I mean, even doing that, there's still maybe 50% of deferred fee, and making, again, if this works out, we're still making, $2 to $3 million fee.
Could I ask a question? So there are a lot of people pushing to get this transaction closed by the beginning of June. So could we, I realize credit committee is today, we're meeting next Thursday, could we go back and have a conversation with our developer, talking
as far as options, yep.
Still, if we can reach a resolution, bring it forward for approval next week with perhaps a slightly modified capital stack?
I'd be up for that. Yeah.
Sounds very logical.
Yeah, I'd be up for that too. My gut's feeling the same as what everyone's saying. That's my gut feeling too. And then I had one other quick question. So this 119 to 95, if they want to close soon, NEF has an investor lined up at 95 cents?
They are working through that, and we are waiting for the partnership agreement so that we kind of see all of the details.
Okay. And why does this need to get closed by June?
The developer, as Caroline said, is providing office space for Providence Community Health Center, and there's a deadline by which they want to get. And the developer being proactive, and I give him a lot of credit for getting out toward the end of the diving board, has ordered materials. He's doing this as a, I don't understand the construction measure, but some prefab, and there are large pieces of construction that are coming and in June, and he's ready to go.
Okay, got it.
So are we pulling this one from?
I don't know what you call it.
I think so.
Come up with some things.
What I would say is, Corey, I will defer to Corey. In order to go before the board, do we require an approval, even if it's a conditional one, from the credit committee?
This is Corey speaking. It's not a requirement. We can certainly do that if there's a proposal now for a particular condition. We can amend the motion, or we can pass on the motion and have the motion heard kind of originally at the board meeting.
I think, because I don't want to speak having not spoken to the developer, perhaps we just pass on this, we'll defer this, and then we can bring it forward to the full board next week. And we can obviously have some conversations prior to that that inform the discussion at the board meeting.
Is everybody comfortable?
I'll make myself available too if we want.
Thank you, Maria.
Okay. Do we want to specify just in the minutes or just informally to senior staff that the board committee sentiment is in favor of the project?
Mm-hmm.
So that can be expressed. We'd like to see this advance. We just want to ensure that it's as efficiently resourced as possible.
Agreed.
Sure. I thought so noted.
Okay. Yep. Good. We will not vote on this agenda item and move to agenda item number 13. Is that?
Which is the corollary. So that is the issuance of the tax-exempt bond. I don't know if the bond amount is not going to change.
Right. You could still vote on this.
I think that's prudent to do then. We'll go through the process then. Okay. So the next agenda item is recommendation for authorization to issue tax-exempt loan to support construction of Copley Chambers 2 and 3 in the amount of $23 million. And Carolyn, you're going to... This could be very brief.
Caroline Dylag, the previous resolution, this request for action is to seek approval of the issuance of Rhode Island Housing Tax Exempt Bonds and not to exceed amount of $23 million for a tax exempt private placement transaction with the construction lender Citizens Bank NA and permanent lender Berkeley Point Capital doing business as Newmark in conjunction with Freddie Mac. This request is for Copley Chambers 2 and 3, which will provide 124 affordable units at or below 1% AMI Rhode Island Housing will issue the tax-exempt note to citizens. Rhode Island Housing will advance the loan proceeds to the borrower with our standard obligations. Rhode Island Housing will charge a one-time issuer fee of 1% and an annual servicing fee of 25 basis points on the construction and permanent loan. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a
motion.
I'll second it. And so this is we're
acting as a
conduit issuer.
Absolutely.
So okay. And we're taking 1 point up front and 25 basis points ongoing.
Yep.
For that service.
Okay. So there's very,
very minimal
any financial risk.
Yes.
It's reputational risk.
Yep.
I guess any comments or questions? Corinne, take a vote on it.
I want to note for the record that Marie Berry's left as of 11:30. We still have a quorum with Commissioner Sarah Cabral and Kevin Wolf present. With that said, commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending firm approval of, if you're in favor of approving, recommending approval to issue tax-exempt loans for the construction of Copley Chambers 2 and 3 in the amount of $23 million, please say aye.
Aye.
Nay, with two affirmative votes,
the
motion
is
approved. Thank you.
Thank you. Now go to item number 14, which is recommendation for approval of development
affordable housing 2 program, so known as EAH2.
So I'm going to take that and I will try and be as quick as I can. I will run it over. So the development of affordable housing, it was previously known as ARPA production, and even before that as Rhode Island Rebounds. The $75 million that was earmarked for this program is the mainstay of the RFP we issued. We issued 31 applications. We're recommending 15 in 11 different communities, and that's an amount of approximately $57 million. In the interest of time, because we've discussed the funding, I'm going to simply list the awards and limit any project-related comments to the four projects that we haven't discussed. So we're recommending $6 million for Rosebrook Common, $1 million for 60 for Central Street, $5 million for South Point Common, $6 million for Reynolds Farm, $1,500,000 for Copley Chambers 2 and 3, $5,800,000 for Broad Street, $4 million for Summer Street, $4,010,000 for Lockwood, $5,550,000 for Adi Bethune, $4,550,000 for Potter's Tigray, and $3,874,000 for the Avenue. The next project is Pocasset Reserve, which is a 275-unit new construction development in Tiverton. 25% of the units must be affordable households below 80% of AMI. We are recommending funds for phase one, which will consist of 129 units, of which 32 will be affordable. This site has water and sewer, and the proposed award of $640,000 is $20,000 per affordable unit. Ralph A. Russo is an existing 22-unit affordable housing development located in Johnston. It was originally constructed in 1990 and had little to no investment since then, so it's in need of substantial rehabilitation. The 22 units are all subsidized by a project-based voucher contract, and we're recommending an award of $2,100,000. And we do expect that we will be bringing this project to firm commitment in the next couple of months. The next one is Villages at Manville. 72-unit development. It did receive low-income housing tax credits last year. All 72 of these are now affordable to households below 80% of AMI. Since preliminary commitment, rising interest rates and rising construction costs did create a funding gap. They've done some value engineering. They have gotten a small award from the town of Lincoln, and we are recommending an amount of $1,728,817. I apologize for the oddball number. And we expect this will be, the requirement of this is that the development close no later than September 30th of this year. The last one is Millrace, which we've seen several times. This project did receive firm approval in June of 2022. However, subsequent to the firm approval, the developer encountered a couple of issues related to the state historic credits. One would impose Davis Bacon, which would increase the cost of the development beyond the value of the credits. And the second issue is a place in service deadline of 2023, which the developer is not going to be able to meet. So he is seeking approximately $4,500,000 of funds to replace the historic tax credits. $4 million of it is being recommended as part of the DAH2 action here. So in total, we're requesting $57,072,817 in funds for 15 projects.
Thank you very much, Anne. I have a motion to approve. Sarah, I'll second it. Questions? In the write-up, it mentioned that the program review criteria was amended to remove the initial per-project cap on the system. Maybe go into explaining that.
Sure. So originally, there was a $4 million cap. James could speak to sort of the genesis of that, but as we were, we did our best to try and spread these dollars around as much as possible, but some of the funds are not eligible for every project. So CRP, you have to be in a QTT, ARF, you have to be Blight, right? So in order to get these projects done based on the cost, it became apparent that some of these deals needed more than $4 million.
Yeah. The short version is under prior leadership, the Department of Housing requested that as a condition of the program, as Anne described, as we got into looking at these programs and what we would need to do to make the development of affordable housing dollars go to the most projects and, frankly, create more units. It was clear that we needed to remove that, and with the cooperation of the Department of Housing this round, we were able to achieve that, and it was approved by PRO and actually just signed the amendment to that yesterday. So we're in good shape. So thank you to the Secretary for his assistance with that in moving these projects forward.
So I'm sorry. So originally had a $4 million cap, and now there is no cap?
That's correct.
Okay. Got it. I just had questions about mill rates. I'm sorry.
No, you are absolutely... one of the conditions of this award is that this entire transaction be closed by August 31st of this year.
Yeah. Just if I can add, too, I know that the developer is pursuing a legislative fix to some of the issues that caused this gap. Obviously, given the schedule of the General Assembly, it's likely that that would not come to fruition if it does until the end of June, be effective July 1. So as a hedge against that, not going forward, that's what some of these funds were requested. If legislation comes forward where it solves some of the problem with the historic credits, then not all of these funds will be required and we'll be able to put them back into the pool for the next go-round.
I understand this is one pot of federal money being swapped out for another pot of federal money, but...
Actually, it's being swapped out for state
money.
These are state historic credits that impose...
Oh, state, right, yeah. Right. I'm sorry. Thank you. Right. So in a way, that's a good thing. But it's still, as I tallied this up, and I'm probably off a little bit, but at least $210,000 a unit and soft debt, which doesn't include AHP and some of the other debt,
yep.
And zero hard debt. Is that...
Yeah, this is a very heavily subsidized project.
And again, we don't have any steady subsidy for project
for this particular program.
Mm-hmm. But we don't have any caps overall. It's the total amount of cost dollars going into a project.
We don't currently know.
The amount per affordable unit being developed.
Yeah.
We look just up above, and granted, this is the mill redevelopment versus a new construction, but Manville, 70,000 units, soft dollars, versus three times or more that for this one.
Mm-hmm. Then they are different. They're different developers.
Railings on, you know, put into something. Do we have some subjective, wow, this is a transformational project, it's really worth it?
Well, and I think that we do factor that in. I think, obviously, that NeighborWorks has been working on this project for a while. It will be transformative to that section of Woonsocket in a very meaningful way. It will serve some very low-income individuals. I would say also that it's a unique problem that we have not had, because we have not had the level of soft dollars to put into a project, whether it's this or whether it's a 4%. There's no accident why we haven't really, apart from Women's Development in Exeter, have not been able to do 4% new construction, because we've never had enough money to over-subsidize a unit before. So in many cases, we're negotiating these kind of uncharted waters with these dollars that are a spike in what we're able to give out. I mean, ideally, we will get more funds down the road, but, you know, tomorrow is never promised, and I don't know that the next go-around you will see the same level of subsidy simply because we won't have it available. But it's certainly something, we hear very clearly, and we can certainly take a look at and have discussions about what those levels should be given the universe of projects that we tend to see.
Okay. There are steps.
No, thank you for asking.
Okay. Your questions. Please take a look.
Mm-hmm. Committee members, if you're in favor of recommending approval of development of affordable housing 2 program funding awards as presented at this meeting, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. For the record, the motion is approved with 2 affirmative votes.
Great. Thank you. Getting there. Number 15, recommendation for approval of middle income program funding awards. And we'll take this one away.
Yep, and I will go as quickly as I can. Middle income is also funded with the SLRF dollars earmarked for production of housing for incomes below between 80% and 120% of AMI, and it is available for both rental and home ownership. Skip to the salient points. We're recommending approval for 7 proposals in the amount of $9,470,000, which will support 447 for the development of 447 units, of which 132 are middle income. As with the previous RFI, I'm going to focus primarily on the projects that we haven't discussed. We're recommending $960,000 for Rosebrook Commons, which will support 13 middle income units. Central Street is receiving a $1,510,000 middle-income award for typo 19 middle-income unit. The next one is the Studley Building, which is a 65-unit building in downtown Providence. The developer is Paolino Properties. They previously received workforce housing funds for this building for 14 units, which are deed restricted. And they're now seeking to convert an additional 34 units into middle income for residents with incomes below 100% of AMI. The award is $2,090,000. And because this project is complete, the funds will be dispersed as the developer income certifies the residents. The next one is East Point. The developer has submitted a proposal to construct a total of 100 apartments in 2 phases. This award is for phase 1, 50 units, of which 12 will be middle income, up to households with income at 100% of AMI. We're recommending an award of $960,000. The next one is Walker Loft. Developers Odin Properties. It's reconstructing a historic blighted mill in Lincoln, right on the Central Falls border. The development will have 126 total units. 32 will be affordable to households at 80% of area median income. The balance are unrestricted, and this middle income award is $2,230,000, and obviously conditioned upon completion of the capital stack, which is nearly complete at this point. The next one is Georgiaville Place. This is home ownership. It's a 9-unit condominium in Smithfield. Five will be slated as middle income with two at 100% and three at 120%, and the recommended award is $400,000 based on what they're eligible for. And the last one is the Avenue, which we previously talked about, an award of $1,320,000 for 17 units.
Happy to answer any questions.
I have a motion to approve.
Make a motion.
Thank you, sir. I'll second it. Questions or comments about it? And I'll jump in. Just to reiterate, the retainment is 50% of surplus cash for this program.
You know, I'm not sure we've actually talked about that, but which is certainly, I'm not sure if that's a program requirement.
Put me on the spot here.
I honestly don't know that. We'll get that to you before. And it wouldn't necessarily be the case in a homeownership deal.
Yeah,
sure. Okay. I think it's just conceptually, this is a program higher up the income spectrum. So therefore, maybe we should have more stringent criteria as we go higher up the spectrum.
I would say that we did not require this in the workforce housing. It was 100% deferred for the term of the loan, due upon refinancing, although it could be assumed by the new owner. And I think, if memory serves me, we modeled it the same way so that there was no requirement for cash flow. And in a lot of cases, this is the last piece of financing in some complicated capital stacks. And I think that's why it was thought to be pretty silent.
I don't know why this would be less stringent than, say, the production fund. It seems like it should be more so. To me, and I hear that it's due upon sale, but maybe we
might
look into that. Yeah, because in theory, I know this isn't always the case. We have some projects that here that are targeting a lower income, but in theory, yeah, maybe this would be a market rate project in a very good area, and these are units that are below what they're charging, the other units. So I think that maybe we can get, some repayment of that.
So there is a deferred interest rate for 30 years. It is not a cash flow loan. What I would say is this, when we structured this, it was in tandem with the Department of Housing. And so this is not a wholly Rhode Island Housing with a prior leadership, I want to be clear. It is not a wholly Rhode Island Housing program. We based it on our workforce program. And the workforce program, as I recall, was designed because we were trying to target developers that we don't work with, right? Developers of market rate housing and write down the rents.
Sure.
Right. And I think it was designed to be attractive to those folks who were likely doing business with us for the first time and trying to find the value for them in accessing this program and foregoing those the rents they could achieve in their property. So I think that's why that was structured at the time as not a cash flow loan, as just a fully deferred loan. And in the discussions we had with the Department of Housing putting this program together, I think that was the evolution. Because it was working with the workforce program, we didn't want to reinvent the wheel and change its attractiveness level to the type of market rate developers we're trying to bring in. But it's worthwhile.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I also just recall that interest rates were super low. So there's not a lot of, when you can get a loan out on the street at 2.5-3%,
thank you very much
for your 0%, but that's not making a big difference. But when
we're going out here now at 6.5-7%,
I think that's a much bigger subsidy, and maybe we don't need to give away that much.
Yeah, well, again, when we designed this, the Fed had not jumped aboard the train of every couple of weeks raising rates.
Right.
So.
Okay. And then you had also said, Anne, that generally, I don't see it here in a threshold, but you generally like to see that these rents are about 10% below market.
Excuse me, I'm losing my voice. That's the requirement of the program. So we'll find the same market study.
Okay. And then I guess my only other question, deal specific, was Georgiaville Place. So where's the subsidy going? Is it the 80,000 units, I think is what works out to. So is the market price of the for sale units going to be dropped down by 80,000 or how?
It's, I don't have the pro forma in front of me, so I will, I don't know the difference, the delta between the market
right.
and the affordable.
Right.
But there's certainly a discount. It's, they're limited to who they can sell it to and the amount that they can sell it to. And we can certainly get you those differences. I don't have those.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a dollar for dollar reducing by 80,000, but what it is reducing it to people who can afford it within that income band, whatever the sale price
right.
for somebody making.
Most of that subsidy going to.
Okay.
I wouldn't be surprised if it's more than 80,000, given where the market is these
okay.
days.
Okay. I didn't have any other questions.
No.
All right. Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Corinne?
Corinne speaking.
Sure.
Committee members, if you're in favor of recommending approval of middle income program funding awards as presented at this meeting.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. The motion is approved. Two affirmative votes. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thanks, everybody.
Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We now have agenda item number 16, which is recommendation for approval of community revitalization program funding awards. And all right.
Finally.
Patient.
I'm very quiet.
No, he's had a lot to do with the
program. This is, just quickly, my name is Dean Harrison. This is regarding the community revitalization program, other ways known as CRP. It's funded with state and local fiscal recovery funds for the production of affordable housing for units with incomes at or below 80%. We received 13 applications submitted for a total request of $18,106,852. Five did not meet threshold or did not qualify for funding under the program guides. Proposals submitted in response to the consolidated request for proposals that did not initially apply for CRP funding, but were otherwise eligible and met these threshold criteria, were scored under the CRP criteria as well. Rhode Island Housing staff is recommending CRP funding for 10 proposals in the amount of $16,413,250. For the interest of time, Ann has been, staff has gone through most of the funding for the project that's being recommended, so I'm really just going to basically announce the amounts we're requesting for each application, and also I'll touch base on just two of them that haven't been presented before. Burnin Mill, $1,838,250. Mill Race, $500,000. Central Street, $2 million. Copley Chambers, 2 and 3, $2 million. Burr Street Homes, $2 million. Summer Street, $1.9 million. Walker Lofts, $2 million. Potted Tigray, $2 million. The Avenue, $2 million. And 24 Inkerman Street, $175,000. I'm going to briefly touch on Burnin Mills, which is also a historic mill located in Woonsocket, very close to Mill Race, which will be redeveloped into 60 units of rental housing. The developer is Brissa Ventures, LLC. They are utilizing income averaging and all the units be restricted to households with incomes at or below 80%. There will be a mix of efficiencies, one bedrooms and two bedroom units. The developer is similar to Millrace, the developer had previously received state historic tax credits, but the two issues that Ann mentioned in Millrace has made the project somewhat uneconomical, given that Davis-Bacon requirements are required on the development if they use the historic, state historic, excuse me, and also the placement service deadline of 2023. The the CIP money going to this project is really a dollar-for-dollar replacement of the state historic tax credits and intend to complete the capital stack. The CIP for this, for Bernard Mills, is $1,838,250 in contingent upon completion of standard underwriting and closing no later than October 31st, 2023. As previously Ann mentioned, Walk is lost, so I will skip that one. The last one is 24 Inkerman Street. This is a Sojourner House project located at 24 Inkerman Street in Providence. Sojourner House acquired the building using the Rhode Island Houses Site Acquisition Program grant in 2022. Sojourner House has a subrecipient grant agreement with Rhode Island Housing to support 15 households with permanent supportive housing through the continuum of care. And Sojourner House has applied to the City of Providence for the balance of the funding needed to complete the rehabilitation. So this award is for 24 Inkerman Street is recommended amount of $175,000. In summary, we are requesting approval of $16,413,250 in CIP funds for the 10 separate projects. Now I can read. Yeah.
I'll be very direct this time.
I'll make a motion.
Thank you, and I will second it. Do you have any questions about this one? Program?
No.
Okay. All right. Just curious, Michael, maybe you could talk about Vernon Mills and Mill Race a little bit. I believe they're going to be fairly close to each other. Are they in the same submarket? Or so they should be generally able to achieve the same rent levels?
I think so.
Okay. And I don't have a pro forma. I can't really see and so on. But why would Vernon be able to support, you know, $40,000 a unit and hard debt and mill rate zero?
Yeah, and I don't have a pro forma in front of me either.
Okay. I'm just wondering, are they not performing the same rent levels, or is it one has higher expense assumptions, or?
We can certainly get that to you. I don't know if, Seth, if you sort of looked at the underwriting proposal recently, but we can certainly provide that to you.
Yeah, and I think Vernon Mills, you know, I think they did a really good job trying to, you know, value engineer. They're deferring some fee. You know, they brought a lot to the table to try to, like, strip out some pieces of the deal to make it a little more economically feasible. So, mm-hmm. You know, from Vernon Mills, for example, I know the developer's been very motivated and has worked hard to make this deal work.
We can certainly get you the rents. I think there are a few more 80%. I think the difference here is there are some 80% units.
They're skewing for a higher.
Yeah. So we'll get you that.
Yeah.
And we can look at the expenses too. I do recall Mill Race being a little bit higher operating expenses.
Okay. And the income average piece of Vernon Mills as well, they'd be able to, you know, generate additional tax credits in that case as well. So, you know, that kind of helped.
They should be generating the same level of tax credits, right?
Right, but there are some higher levels.
But the rent that they're in, I see. Rent. Okay. Questions about any? Okay, great. Would you please take a...
This is Corey speaking. Commissioners, if you are in favor of recommending approval of Committee Revitalization Program funding award as presented, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The ayes have it with two affirmative votes. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. We will now move on to getting close. I hear the stomach rumbling. it's in the 7th. We're doing like 3 years worth of deals in one meeting. That's crazy. Recommendation for approval of capital magnet fund awards. And you're going to present.
I'm going to be even shorter than
okay,
my other one. Rhode Island Housing has actually received 4 capital magnet fund grants. The most recent award was $12 million. We're proposing recommendations for 7 projects. all of which we've discussed, Ralph Russo, Central Street, Lockwood Plaza, Copley, Potter Seagrave, Addie Bethune, and the Avenue, and in total, $3,316,000 of capital magnet for seven projects. I can go into more detail if you want, but I think we probably read it all.
Maybe if you could speak to it. It seems like this pot of money wasn't as utilized as maybe some of the others. We had $12 million, I think, in the November NOFA, and only $3.3 million, as you say, going out. So maybe just speak to that a little bit.
This is a challenging pot of money to use for a couple of reasons. One is, so as part of our application, we have certain metrics that we need to meet. So 40% of the units in each of these developments needs to be below 50% of AMI, so that knocks out a lot of proposals. The other piece is we have a disproportionate number of units that have to be in qualified census tracts, or what the CDFI calls the areas of economic distress, which sort of limits it that much more. So while it's on a grant basis, we have to look at it on a project-by-project basis, and so that's the numbers come out the way they do.
And so how much longer do we have to use?
We have 5 years. So you have 2 years to commit. We didn't sign the agreement until December of 2023, so we have until December of 2025 to commit the funds, and December of 2028 to spend the money. So we're good. And well, this is a great source of funding when you can find the right projects. We also have to, I think the other metric is we have to fund over 1,000 units, so it's balancing large projects and small projects.
Okay. Have questions?
No.
Have we made a motion on this one?
No.
All right. Would you please make
a motion? Make a motion.
Okay, and I'll second. Great. And we don't have any questions. Okay.
This is Corey. If you're in favor of recommending approval of capital magnet fund award as presented, please say aye.
Aye.
Nay. The motion is approved with two affirmative votes. Thank you.
Great. Agenda item 18, recommendation for approval of housing production fund, extremely low income operations, also known as HPF ELI awards. And
Mike Vaccaro is going to do this right.
Thank you. I'd like to present the request for approval of Housing Production Fund Extremely Low Income Operating Reserve, or HPF ELI awards. And since this program is a long-term operating support for a site that we've already discussed, it will be administered through the Housing Division in the cooperation I'll be presenting this today. Brief history, the Housing Production Fund was established by the state of Rhode Island in June of 2021. By amendment to the Housing Resources Act, the HPS specifically establishes a priority for households either exiting homelessness or earning no more than 30% of AMI. In conjunction with the Rhode Island Housing Resources Commission, Rhode Island Housing has established program guidelines for the HPS ELI program, and the General Assembly has appropriated $10 million for this purpose. These funds will bridge the gap between residents' ability to pay 30% of their gross household income toward rent and establish 50% low-income housing tax credit rent for the applicable unit size. In November 2022, Rhode Island Housing issued a request for proposals for HPF ELI funds as part of a consolidated funding round. In response, we received 12 proposals requesting over more than $8.5 million. Of the 12 proposals, we recommend funding 7 HPF ELI proposals in the amount of $4.6 million. The awards will support 62 newly created 30% AMI residential units to be funded with low-income housing tax credits for 15 years. Staff will continue to review the remaining 5 applications and expects to bring additional awards for approval at a later date. We focused on the new tax credit developments and the new production ones. So we're going to really talk about all these. I'll run through them quickly. Rosebrook Commons, 13 units, at or below 30% of AMI, for 15-year support, totals $1.022 million. South Point Commons, 16 units in 15 years, $1.13 million. At a Bethune, six, 6 units in 15 years, $472,000. Broad Street Homes. 6 units in 15 years for $474,000. Pius Highbury. 5 units in 15 years, $380,000. Reynolds Farm, 11 units, 20 for 15 years, $716,000. And the Avenue, 5 units in 15 years, with an award of about $400,000.
Great, thank you.
That was detailed. I mean, it's not easy. We've discussed all those projects.
Thank you.
I just have one question.
So wait, make a motion.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's
sorry.
Fine.
Make a motion.
Great, thank you. And I'll second it. Now you can ask your
sorry. Question. Of the, so 12 proposals were received and 7 are for a recommendation that we talked about. But the remaining funds, did you say you go back to the 5 that weren't ready for recommendation and then you review them, or do you accept new proposals?
Both.
Okay.
Right. So we will go back and look at those 5 again. We want to focus on the new production.
Okay. First. Okay.
All right. I just didn't
understand really what you said. Got it.
Is this program, and from a compliance perspective, from a property owner's perspective as well, maybe in terms of how they run the program, Will it be aligned, I don't know, similar to Section 8 project based or housing choice voucher?
Sure.
And so that you all don't have, oh, we got to go this route, that, you know. And
so we're not linked to the Section 8 level of just issuing a subsidy, but we've kind of moved forward from the old Neighborhood Opportunities Program that is a deep analysis of operating expenses each quarter. This is where we slide through the wards, the difference between the 30% rent and the 50% rent. Our intention for administration is going to be a quarterly requisition where they provide evidence that the person occupying the unit is qualified to live there under this program, and we would pay that operating support for that quarter instead of doing that deep dive into their expenses. Because, you know, obviously, property owners are unique with their expenses and not all the same, so we're going to be very consistent with our.
So, unlike, say, the site-based Section A, where any time a tenant has a change in income, you have to do an income recertification, you're saying it's going to be done on a quarterly basis?
They would do an annual income certification. There's no specific federal requirement for an interim certification. They would do an annual recertification, and that would be just annually.
And I think what's important here is we are only subsidizing the difference between the 30% rent and the 50% rent.
So it's a shallower subsidy on a per unit basis than something like the Housing Choice Voucher program would be.
Okay.
But unlike the NOP program, which was, as Mike said, based on an analysis of what the need was at that time, this will be a more consistent subsidy that the developers can rely upon, and it'll be much easier also for us to administer because it'll be that delta between the 30 and the 50% rents, which changes annually.
Okay, so you're not looking at 30% of the tenant's income. You're just 30%.
No, we're relying upon an income certification that the person in that unit is a 30% resident.
Very predictable for a syndicator,
got
too.
It.
Like, they
right.
Know, they can
okay.
Underwrite
so
the 50% rent.
Right.
Okay, that makes more sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Increase or decrease, we're going to base it on that 30% level, whether they're
right.
Level
regardless of
right.
Okay. What happens there. Okay. How is the reserve going to be held and how invested? Is that
the developer gets to do that and
decide that, or are we holding it?
No, so this is state money, so we've got to get the money from the state.
Yeah.
And then we would hold it in a reserve and earn interest on it.
Okay. All right. Do we have the staff to do all the compliance for this?
We have staff now that are doing those deep dives. Maybe I'm not making these requests, but this will be a much
just thinking with each of these different funding programs, they're going to come in a lot of different nuances.
Yes.
Yep.
And we do have...
It's a messed up or...
We do. And we do have, thankfully, admin fee baked into each one of these programs that will support staff as necessary. And if we find as we go along that we need more staff, we will have the ability to do that. That was, you know, a condition of all of these programs getting off the ground. Yeah, it's just something that we need to do because, as you say, there's nobody here who's not working hard already. So when you layer on other programs, you know, we have to make sure we have the capacity to do that.
Speaking. Commissioners, if you're in favor of recommending approval of Housing Production Fund Extremely Low Income Operating Reserve Awards as presented at this meeting, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. With two affirmative votes. Thanks.
Andy.
Aye.
That's James.
This is James Comer. Like many of the programs that you have, awards that you have approved here today, pre-development program was created with SFRF dollars approved by Treasury and by the state of Rhode Island to allocate $10 million to Rhode Island Housing for the purposes of distributing pre-development grants to developers who are in the process of assessing the feasibility of a project, paying for some architectural engineering costs, some site work or site investigation, all of the costs, Kevin, as you know, that go into determining whether or not to proceed with a project. The program is structured that applicants would be eligible for a $100,000 grant if the total development cost of the project is below $1 million, or $250,000 if it's above $1 million, with the idea that it will enable these projects to get moving quicker, support some of our developers in doing activities that they might not have the ready cash to do, and provide us with a pipeline of more viable projects given the amount of investigation that people can do up front. So it's a pretty straightforward program. We have had a lot of applications already. We would, under the way it's currently structured, have the ability to award $2.5 million in this fiscal year, and then ideally in the next fiscal year, beginning July 1st, be able to award the remaining $7.5 million. Happy to answer any questions you may have.
A motion to approve this.
I make a motion.
So this is not necessarily a capacity building program.
This is a very project specific grant. It is. I have this piece of land that I'm interested in. I want to see if there's soil problems. I want to see if there's anything that would preclude me from going forward.
Right.
I want a grant to investigate this. I mean, that's just one example. You could use it for a number of other things, you know, some preliminary architectural engineering work, surveying, you name it.
Right. In the program description, I didn't see anything that got to the question of need.
In terms of,
is this open to anyone regardless of need?
It is open to anyone. And again, as I would mention, these are programs that were structured with the collaboration of the Department of Housing. So this is something we've arrived at after an extended period of discussion about the program design embedded through the state pandemic recovery office, who also gets to weigh in on the program design. So all of these things were worked through, and this is the program that we've arrived at.
Okay. It strikes me that the money should be going to those developers and developments that need it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is not a capacity building program, but my two senses, maybe we can use it to help a little bit in that area. I don't see any,
well, I think,
you know, any minority or women owned businesses or those that are just kind of, I don't know, first-gen kind of developers group, any consideration for that?
I think the good thing about this program is that it's reviewed by a committee of folks with a variety of different viewpoints. And it's not just a straight development group. It's folks from throughout the agency, and they bring a lot of good perspective in that regard. I would say, based on some of the preliminary conversations we've had, that we're seeing, for the most part, a broad range of folks that are applying for this. And I think you're correct. I think there's some ability for folks to build their capacity to do things that they might not have the internal capacity to do. But I think the preliminary point of this, as conceived, again, by the state, was to expedite projects and to kind of, because this, like all the other SFRF dollars, are time limited and need to be allocated by next year and awarded by 2026, to speed things through the pipeline as quickly as we can. I think certainly, you know, in terms of a longer commitment to this, if we're able to make that happen, I think what you bring to the table makes a lot of sense. I just think right now it's very hard to say Certain developers will qualify for this and certain won't, and where do you draw that line? I think the majority of folks who will apply for this will probably come from our nonprofit partners and from, as you say, maybe some first-time or newer developers. But, you know, once we get through the first round of these, you know, we can report back and see where we're at and see what we're seeing.
Fair enough. Okay. Comments or questions? No? Would you please take a vote?
This is Karen Meyer speaking. Commissioner Fisher and Schaefer are recommending approval of the ARPA redevelopment program as presented. Please say aye.
Aye.
The opposed say nay. Two affirmative votes, the motion is affirmed.
Discussion on it.
I would like to say. Yes, I would like to say you have just reviewed the pipeline in detail.
And you don't have enough.
So just one other item that I would just like to let people know, let the commissioners know. The board meeting next week, the governor will be attending the board meeting to say a few words about the scope of these awards and, you know, his commitment and investment in affordable housing. So just to be aware, that's going to happen. I don't know what form that will take. It'll probably be at the beginning of the meeting, but I'm sure Secretary Breyer will be able to give us more information about that. But just want to let you guys know for your own edification.
Great. Thank you. And I think that we talked about this up front, but I think in terms of presentation, the governor's office, are you aware, are they coming up with their own? On that, or is that something that
I would
be doing, or how do we coordinate to make sure we get that?
I will tell you that our communications team is in frequent communication with the governor's team and with the team at the Department of Housing, so that any public event or public statement will be a coordinated one that has all the information from us as far as the deals, and, you know, we'll have everybody who needs to be quoted will be quoted.
Okay. I think at a minimum, at least if we can go through that 100. Number of 166
million.
How much of that is allocated?
Mm-hmm.
How much remains? When is it going to be spent?
Yep.
How many projects? How many units? Maybe a graphic of the state, where they are.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm sure we can put something together. As I hear the silent screams of the communication team on this call.
Well, I mean, we just like put so much effort into figuring which deals to get the money, but I mean, it'd be good to spend a little bit of time, obviously, on some presentation.
Yeah, I think we could put something
we're on
together
top
in a couple
of
slides. That'll...
Okay, I'm sure you are. Thank you.
That was Chris.
Yeah. All right.
No, that was Carol.
Oh, Carol.
I hope you're enjoying yourself.
I'm not.
Of course,
no.
He's on this call, so.
Uh-oh. We will, how about a motion to adjourn? No? I'll second that one.
This is Corey speaking. Commissioners, all those in favor of adjoining this meeting, say aye.
Aye.
There you have it. A unanimous vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone.
Everybody.